Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a highly acclaimed actress, writer, producer, and director who's brought us some of the most memorable performances in classic films, including Goodfellas, Guilty by Suspicion, Cape Fear, Alive, Search and Destroy, To Die For, Happy Texas, Message in a Bottle, and many more. And yes, all of those blood-curdling screams in The Last Temptation of Christ are hers. And yes, she's the girl who got her face bitten off by Robert De Niro in Cape Fear. On television, you've seen her in dozens of movies, miniseries, and TV shows, including Weapons of Mass Destruction, Bella Mafia, Lansky, Action, Law and Order SVU, The Skinny, Goliath, and 6 Feet Under, for which she received an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series. She also created, wrote, and frequently directed the world's first ever branded web series, Easy to Assemble, in addition to winning a whole slew of prestigious awards, including 6 Webbies. Our guest, in my opinion, also achieved the impossible. She actually made it cool to shop at IKEA. Our guest is also a great lover of classic films, which comes as no surprise, given that she's the granddaughter of the legendary actor Melvin Douglas. She can often be seen on the Turner Classic Movies Network, interviewing cinematic giants and hosting the Spotlight series, including Funny Ladies, Second Looks, and Trailblazing Women. She's participated in scores of documentaries about film history, and she produced and hosted the highly popular podcast, The Film Scene, in which she interviews celebrities about classic movies. Her first book, entitled I Blame Dennis Hopper and Other Stories from a Life Lived in and Out of the Movies, was named one of the best books of 2015 by Entertainment Weekly. And her latest book is a real gem for film buffs. It's called Connecticut in the Movies, From Dream Houses to Dark Suburbia, and it explains how the cinematic perception of Connecticut, originally created in Hollywood movies like Bringing Up Baby and Christmas in Connecticut, has shifted in recent years. The book offers some surprising conclusions about just what it means to be a Connecticut movie. I'm delighted to welcome Ileana Douglas to our show. Ileana, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. I love listening to all of my accomplishments.
Well, I only skimmed the surface. I want to start by quoting something to you that Mike Nichols told you. He said that as an actress, you have a unique ability to be both in a movie and outside it, like you're also commenting to us in the audience. Were you aware that you had that effect on the audience?
No, not at all. That's why it was, he gave me the key to the second part of my career, because when I met him and he said that, you know, the story was that I was with the director, Glenn Gordon Caron, who had directed me in Picture Perfect, wonderful person, created Moonlighting. And we went to see The Graduate, and because Mike Nichols was going to be there, and Buck Henry, who I'd worked with on To Die For, so I had a little bit of an in. But I brought my album, my Mike Nichols and Elaine May album, for him to sign. And as we were standing in line, Glenn said to me, "Only you could get away with something like that." And I said, "What? It's Mike Nichols." So I was there as a fan. Like, I never thought of myself as also being in films. I'm there now as a fan of Mike Nichols to get my album signed. And when I handed over the album, he looked at me, you know, piercingly, and critiqued me and my acting career by saying, "You know what I like about you? When I see you in a movie, you're in the movie. It's as if you're in the movie, but then you're also in the audience commenting to us." Your quote. And I had this epiphany. I said, "My God, you've explained my entire life," because my entire life I have felt like, is this a movie? Because I feel like I've been outside watching myself, somehow not in control of my own destiny. The plot seems to just be moving on its own. And then sometimes you're in the movie, you know, you're in New York Stories, or you're in the place. And I've always had that feeling. And I think it probably goes back again to my childhood, where, you know, my parents, you know, wanted to live, because it was the 70s and this kind of hippie existence. And I never felt like I really fit in that, because we grew up in Connecticut. And then when I met when I was hanging out with my grandfather and had this realization, oh my God, these movies that I like, that I'm watching, these black and white movies, where again, I would always project myself away from my life into the movie. I was in the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies, as many kids, I think, do. And so then when I met, you know, when I was hanging out with my grandfather, I was like, wait a minute. And that set upon this idea of being literally in films. But I think that it's been that kind of back and forth ever since. I've never come to really to terms with it. I still haven't.
Well, now everyone knows that you've loved movies your entire life, and you wrote something in your first book that really moved me, Ileana. You said, "I think all movie lovers have some sort of void or sadness in them that movies fill." Ileana, I've never heard anyone express their love for cinema quite so poignantly. How did you come up with that?
Because I think it goes back to, again, you know, feeling as if, you know, being a little kid, and it's New Year's Eve, and it's supposed to be a time where you feel, you know, joy and togetherness, and you're with the family. But I didn't feel that. I felt joy watching, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I felt like I wanted to be in their world. It was soothing and perfect and peaceful, and everybody wore beautiful clothing and so I just felt. And then especially it started to click in as I grew up, and then more and more I began to feel, you know, again, not really finding, where do I belong in this world or that world? I never could find a place for myself. And then when I saw Richard Dreyfuss on screen in American Graffiti at the drive-in, And I realized my whole persona was that I said, that's my persona, is that I've somehow been cast in this life here, sitting in the back seat, making people laugh, being a class clown, but it's not really who I am. And I can't really express who I am. And somehow I think that people who love the movies feel that. They feel as if they have something authentic in them that, but they can't express it because they'll be made fun of in some way. And slowly but surely, I think show business, you know, or running off to the circus, gives us that ability to expose these extremely deep feelings you have of empathy, you know, which are unexplainable because you're a kid. I don't know if I carried them with me from from another life, but I feel that all movie lovers have that.
I do too. I've heard you say that your favorite movie is 20th Century from 1934, starring John Barrymore and Carol Lombard, directed by Howard Hawks, of course. Why is that your favorite movie?
Well, it's you know, I can't say that I have one. It's my favorite comedy of all time. You know, it is because I love just that it's so over the top, and it's comedy carried to the, you know, the absolute extreme in terms of John Barrymore. But on the same plane, I also would say that Limelight with Charlie Chaplin is my favorite movie. Because again, and they're both films are about show business, you know, but to me, again, it's just Limelight for me is the ending of the movie is, I have no words. For me, that's life. Somebody is dying and yet the show goes on. And so those are all the things everything that I looked for, searched for in life, I found in show business. That is my religion.
Well, you had a most unusual childhood, to say the least, which you've alluded to. You went from an upper middle class lifestyle in Connecticut to being poor when your father became a hippie after becoming obsessed with the character that Dennis Hopper played in Easy Rider. Do you think that that hippie lifestyle and poverty contributed to your desire to be an actor?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, again, growing up in that sort of environment, well, first, it forced me to be authentic because I couldn't put on airs because, you know, you had to get by on your wits and being smart and being funny because, you know, my dad wasn't going to be buying me a car, or I wasn't going to be getting into a school or what, you know, so it always made me a little bit scrappy, you know. And again, where do kids pick up tricks that are scrappy? In movies, you know? So that's where I could be challenging, like Richard Dreyfuss, or, you know, assume the persona of Liza Minnelli. You know, I picked people that were confident, but they were always a little bit over the top, you know? I loved watching movies, but I don't know if I ever thought of myself originally as wanting to be in the movies, even though it was kind of, I think it was my destiny. I mean, when I was little, I wanted to be a spy and a writer, and those are always, you know, the things that I wanted to do. But then acting became more and more what I thought I was good at, because I was acting all the time. I mean, from when I was a little kid, I was acting. I was assuming a persona in order to fit in where I grew up. So because I discovered that our lifestyle, which I thought was fun and colorful, was somehow frowned upon on the outside world. So, you know, it's like Lady Godiva suddenly realizing she's naked. When I was growing up, I was poor until I started going to school, and then people made me pretty aware of it. You know, if you didn't have the latest corduroys and the latest this and the latest that. But I mean, I, you know, now again, I have no resentments about my childhood. The ending of the book is realizing, of course, that, and meeting Dennis Hopper and having, you know, these resentments my whole life, and then meeting somebody like Dennis Hopper, and you realize, oh, okay, all these values that were instilled in me because I had to be scrappy have made me the authentic person that I am. And I think that by being authentic, I think that that's the very thing that, going back to Mike Nichols and audiences, I think that's the very thing that people like and expect about me.
Oh, for sure. Well, I can't resist asking you, when you made Search and Destroy with Dennis Hopper, did you ever tell him the effect he had on your childhood?
Of course. That's why it became a major part of the book, because, you know, it had been this running gag throughout my life that, you know, when I finally got to see Easy Rider, which they showed it on television, and they cut the ending because, you know, it was on CBS and they, you know, it was too violent. So I remember watching the movie. This is the movie that we changed our whole life for. So it took quite a few viewings of the film to, you know, I didn't really think much of Dennis Hopper, you know, growing up. And then as I got into movies myself, and then older movies were available, I started to watch him, of course, and some of his early, you know, films like Giant and Rebel Without a Cause. But then by the time I met him, and I was so excited to meet him, and of course the story is in my book, that the day I was going to meet him on the way to the set, our car, the driver kind of nodded off at the wheel. We were in a car accident, and I had a concussion, and because it was such a low budget movie, I had to literally walk to the set holding my head. And by the time I got to the set, I sort of collapsed on the floor. And I, as I write in the book, I, you know, I'm hearing this voice, and it, which sort of sounds like it's my father. And then I realize, oh my God, it's Dennis Hopper. I'm having a biblical moment here where my life is flashing before my eyes. And wait a minute, it really is. Like, so everything in my life has been weirdly, without any effort of trying at all, everything just comes full circle. And so we did, once I got better, yes, I was able to talk to him about, you know, about this. And we, even before I was going to write the book, I wanted to do a documentary with him going around the country, because I was joking. I said, do you know how many lives you've probably ruined, Dennis, like mine? I mean, and all of my rebellious nature comes from that upbringing, which I was so mortified by, you know. And now you can't help but think, yeah, it's a part of me. It's like I challenged the system. And as Dennis Hopper says, that's what it's all about, man.
Yeah, no, I think he absolutely did you a real service, and so did your dad. And when I look at Ileana Douglas, the director, I'm reminded of something you wrote in your first book. You said, I've always had a theory that the need to direct is an obsession with trying to recreate and somehow make sense of your childhood. So that's what you've been doing when you direct movies.
Absolutely. And it's like having a dollhouse and getting to control and rearrange things the way you want it to be, and to kind of examine it and re-understand it. And I see that in other, not all directors, but in most directors' work, you can kind of see the same themes, you know, again, again, and again, come up. And it's just my belief that it all comes from, you know, from these things you learn in childhood.
Now, you, of course, are the granddaughter of the legendary Melvin Douglas, and unfortunately, he did not live long enough to see you become a successful working actress. But besides giving you the best advice ever, which is to always order the club sandwich when you're ordering from room service in a hotel, did he give you any other advice about being an actor?
You know, it sounds very simplistic, but I do think of it every time. He was very concerned when I first started out about my speech and my enunciation and my projection. That was always, he would have all these people around, Myrna Loy, you know, I remember a particular, Patricia Neal, and they would speak, and they had the most beautiful speaking voices. And so then I would want to interject something funny, you know, into the conversation. He was always saying, you know, don't say yeah, yes, and just enunciate, project. And so I was always trying to do that once I got into acting school. Although when I have cassette tapes of myself and I sound a little like Audrey Hepburn with a New York accent. I was
very surprised to learn that a psychic medium told you that Peter Sellers was your guardian angel. I would have thought it would be your grandfather.
I was surprised too. I was trying to reach, you know, my grandfather again. This is one of those stories where, again, I'm just watching the movie. The movie part, I mean, the real life part was that I'd gone back to live in New York. I had a friend, a dress designer named Cynthia Rowley, and she said, we should go see a psychic. And so I said, sure, we'll go see the psychic. And the day comes and she says, oh, I can't make it, but why don't you go by yourself? So go up to the East Side, meet the woman who's a psychic. She opens the door and I start talking about, you know, all my things that I'm asking about. She says, I'm not a psychic, I'm a medium. So I said, oh, okay. She's like, who do you want to contact? So that's what so now I'm, you know, now I'm in the movie or out the movie, you know, I didn't go there expecting to talk to Peter Sellers or my grandfather, but I said, well, I don't know, you can contact my grandfather. So as she was contacting my grandfather, that's when all of a sudden Peter Sellers horns in to the, and I guess because he has a big personality. So he horned in, and because it was a pivotal experience, of course, meeting Peter Sellers, again, going from being a kid and having pictures of him in my room. There was a moment in my childhood where my cinematic world collided when Peter Sellers started dating Liza Minnelli. That was, for me, that was like, okay, this is like Nirvana for me. But they had a short-lived romance. But anyway, so he gave me this advice, you know, on the set, because I was a big Clouseau fan, and my grandfather wanted him to, you know, talk to me. So that's when he imparted, you know, this words of wisdom, which were, he told me to, you know, always ride a unicycle, asked me if I knew how to ride a unicycle, which I thought was kind of a joke. And no, I don't know how to ride a unicycle. And he said, well, you should always ride a unicycle because it's hard and not everybody can do it. And so then that cutting to many, many years later, here I am, complete stranger, contacting Peter Sellers and my grandfather. And then that's when the medium says he has a message for you, and he's on a unicycle. And that's where I nearly just fell out of my chair. Like, that's just bizarre. You know, that was just a bizarre, whether you believe in these things or not, I always take it as, well, let's examine why you needed this message today for whatever reason. And I understand what that message That message to me means that your career hasn't always been easy. You know what I mean? But because you're unique, you have always chosen to ride the unicycle, which is harder and more specialized, but you should be proud of that path. You know, don't try to do something that somebody else is doing. And again, it goes back to, I think, on my own journey, which is to be authentic, you know, to be your authentic self, to work hard and do lots of stuff, but never getting away from who you are.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the message of riding a unicycle. And it's really very eerie that she saw him on a unicycle. That validated for you that she knows what she's doing. It's interesting, though, that although you are riding a unicycle, you're highly unique, you've always said that you've stumbled towards success. And Martin Scorsese once told you that the problem you were going to have in your career is that you're always going to be more interesting than the material you're working with. Which was incredibly insightful. I know it's hard for you to be objective about yourself, but can you see why he said that and that he was absolutely right?
I mean, I couldn't see it then because, of course, I'm starting out and, you know, I'd come out of a little bit of showbiz in that I was lucky enough to do musicals when I was a kid. I was in a, you know, a theater program in Connecticut for three summers called the Hartford Stage Company Youth Theater, where I learned, it was like a sponge soaking up everything. Went to school at the Neighborhood Playhouse, we had amazing teachers, and pretty much started working, you know, right away. I was doing stand-up comedy, I was in an improv group, you know, then I started working for Peggy Siegel. I didn't get jobs again through auditioning. I got the looping job at Last Temptation of Christ. So I was always like, I just want to work. I just want to work. I just want to work. But it wasn't until he said that it made me, as the years started to go by, I realized that was true. And I remember specifically, again, like doing the movie Picture Perfect with Glenn Gordon Caron. And when I'd agreed to do the movie and we talked about doing the movie, he said, "You're the Walter." I always tease him about this. He was like, "You're the Walter. This is the fortune cookie and you're Walter Matthau. You know, you're the Walter Matthau." I was like, "Oh, that sounds great." But, you know, I did so many scenes in that movie that ended up getting cut, you know, because the realization for me was I'm here to support the leading actress, who is Jennifer Aniston, you know, and you've got to support. I mean, that's your job. And as you do films, and those kind of jobs are fun too, you know, message. I love doing message in a bottle, but I am there, my role. And I, as a director, I would be telling an actress the same thing. Like your main role as a professional is you're supporting Robin Wright and you are supporting, you know, you're Eve Arden, you're supporting them. And that's when what Marty said really made sense. And that was the very year that I met, you know, Allison Anders and started trying to do, you know, develop my own projects.
You know, people loved Ethel Mertz just as much as they loved Lucy Ricardo.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
You know, now, Joseph Mankiewicz used to say that all actresses want to be psychoanalyzed. They don't know who they are, so they want to be told who they are. If a man can do it, then any woman will fall in love with him. Do you agree with that?
100%. And it was funny when I remember when I wrote that, I gave it to my editor. He was kind of horrified, like, "This is so sexist. I can't believe you really believe that." I said, It's totally true. How many, and that's why actresses fall in love with their director and get married. And you know, now I'm not necessarily saying it's a good thing, but when I met, you know, again, I love movies and I love the history of movies, and obviously in films, I mean, maybe in other walks of life, but I haven't been in other walks of life. Obviously, cinema is known for, you know, it's ladies, you know, there's been the great ladies' men of cinema. John Frankenheimer, he was a director. Billy Wilder, big ladies' man.
Vincent
And,
Sherman.
oh, good point. Vincent Sherman, big ladies' man. Vincent Sherman, speaking of being psychoanalyzed, he would go into, you know, what Bette Davis needed, what Joan Crawford needed. And then while we're at it, John Huston, you know, another, you know, had affairs, Olivia de Havilland, all sorts of people.
But was he psychoanalyzing these actresses, or did they just want to sleep with them?
No, I think it's, and Joe Mankiewicz in particular was into psychoanalyzing them. So when we went out to dinner, you know, I was in, he went to see, you know, he went to see Cape Fear, and we were having dinner, and I just expected mainly to have dinner with Joe, you know, Joe Mankiewicz, who I adored. But he went into this really long, completely detailed analysis of my character in Cape Fear. And I was shocked because it was all my homework that I had, in fact, put into the character. And it was incredibly astute, and it was nothing that I had shared with Marty or Robert De Niro. It was my own personal homework that I had brought into the part. So I thought that the fact that he picked up on that was pretty astute. And, you know, he started again to, I think you're the kind of person who such, you know, and I in that minute said, oh, I can see why he's a big, I can tell why he's a big ladies' man. You know, because it's like, tell me who I am. Tell me more about me.
Well, I loved how you described working with Robert De Niro. You said it's like waking up and realizing you're on a tightrope 100 stories up with the world's greatest tightrope artist and wondering how the hell you got there. Did it ever get any easier as you got to work with him again?
Well, it certainly did because I watched in both Goodfellas and then Guilty by Suspicion other actors working with him that were kind of self-destructing out of just fear of, you know, being in the ring with Muhammad Ali. You know what I mean? They would lose their confidence. And he is very much an actor that I realized he's reacting off of you. So I you go you if you have the impression that you're going to go into this thing and he's Robert De Niro and all I have to do is stand back and he's going to make me look good, he is not that kind of an actor. He's actually more a reactor off of what you are doing. And so once I realized that, I said, okay, I just got to go into this thing and just totally make a fool of myself. I knew that, you know, the crew and everybody would be like, what is she doing? What is she doing? But I just did it. And luckily they let me do it. And, you know, and he worked on, he, of course, then he kicks into high gear and then you're really, you know, kind of going at it. But yes, there is absolutely that moment that you have where, you know, cameras are about to shoot and you just go, how did I get here? But I feel that way all the time. So, you know, in movies, well, not so much anymore, but every once in a while, you know, you were something gets thrown at you and you go, okay, we're filming this. This is forever. This is it's happening right now. I am not prepared at all. And action.
Somehow it works because it's magic when you do it. One of my favorite movies is Alive. And for the benefit of our viewers, it's the true story of how a rugby team from Uruguay survived a plane crash in the Andes Mountains in 1972. Ileana, you wrote that working with Ethan Hawke was life-altering for you. In what way?
Well, again, he was one of those people that reminded me of, where I'd come from. I mean, he's really an artist. I have tremendous amount of respect for him. I joined the movie because at that point in my career, you know, to take a sort of smaller co-starring part, you know, was some people on my team, I guess, you know, had mixed feelings about it. But I just really thought this is going to be an amazing experience. You know, this is why you get into movies. Like, not everything is about a big marquee film. This was a life-altering experience, which it exceeded my expectations. But, you know, Ethan, he played the guitar and we did talent shows. And it reminded me of we painted pictures, you know, and it reminded me of all the things that I used to do in acting school, where you are very much a free spirit and you don't really care about what people think. And you start to get as your career starts to become successful, you just start thinking about, well, what's the next thing I should do in my career? And it brought me very much back to, you know, listening to music and being in a creative state of mind, you know, all the time. And when I look at his career, again, he always makes, you know, incredibly interesting choices. He stayed true to himself. And I just think he's just someone really that I admire. And there's so many people that I work with that I admire, but you know, he's a real bohemian artist, and I admire that about him.
Yeah, he's just great. And I love the fact that you care more about the craft than the career. And another one of my favorite Ileana Douglas movies is To Die For, because your portrayal of Janice was so memorable for all of us because we really experienced the plot through your character's perspective. But the movie was classified as a Black comedy. Do you think it was more of a social commentary film?
Completely. I mean, I don't really know why it got labeled as a Black comedy, because it is very much a satire, and it's a satire of the social mores of what was happening in America, which was this idea of becoming, you're not anybody unless you're famous, you know, which now obviously now seems very prescient, you know, where everybody is famous. We're all famous, but
for a minute or so.
Yes, but that, and what was also unique about the film was that everybody forgets that there's a film within the film. It's not a straight up narrative. There's a narrative film, and then they're making a film about the main character. I mean, now when you have, you know, shows like The Office, we've come to expect this, but I think it was way, way ahead of his time. And Gus Van Sant, again, was a director that I literally cannot believe I was getting to work with him. I was so enamored of Gus Van Sant and loved his films, you know, so much.
That was a terrific movie. I was very intrigued, Ileana, that you described your movie, Grace of My Heart, as a woman's picture. How do you define a woman's picture?
Well, we set out to make what we call the 1940s melodrama woman's picture, you know, in the sense that a Douglas Sirk film was, that it was geared specifically towards the journey, the inner life of a woman and her coming of age, of how her whole life, you know, her whole life, and then how her whole life is changed by the three different men that she is involved with. And it's not really until the end of the film, you know, when she's, you know, age 40, that, you know, that she finally puts all of her different selves together. And that's why I think it's really, you know, a woman's picture, which I'm not embarrassed to say. I mean, I don't, you know, we don't say anymore, like, well, it's a real woman's picture. But, you know, Mildred Pierce it's a woman's picture. It's a great movie, and we may be enjoying it. You know, now it's classified as a film noir, but I don't like the idea that they've taken a woman's picture sort of away from us in a way, you know?
Well, you wrote, produced, and directed a wonderful documentary about the many challenges of filmmaking called Everybody Just Stay Calm. My question to you is, are you ever able to tell while you're shooting a film that it's going to be a big hit, or conversely, whether it's going to be a flop?
No, I don't. I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, you can't, you're certainly on movies, probably the bigger budget movies that are more chaotic, where they have a lot of rewrites and things going on, where, you know, you're not really sure. But I would when I was shooting To Die For, I thought it was going to be a blockbuster. I mean, so I was sort of surprised. I think we had a regime change during the making of the movie, and so it stumbled a bit, and then it got into Cannes, and then it kind of became a cult classic, and, you know, it's obviously remembered, but it wasn't a blockbuster, and so that definitely surprised me. I certainly knew, probably more, I think more than anybody, because I was on set every single day, I definitely said, I knew Goodfellas was going to be huge. It sounds like I'm stating the obvious now, but if you go back to 1989, which is, I think, when we shot it, you know, I was there watching them shoot the scenes with Joe Pesci, and I said, he's going to win an Oscar, you know. But, however, I also thought John Turturro was going to win an Oscar for Quiz Show. I mean, I had all of my money. To this day, that to me is one of the biggest robberies of all time.
Quiz Show.
John Turturro and Quiz Show. If anybody wants to learn anything about acting, I'm probably, again, my top 10 performances of all time. And I mean, I could watch John Turturro in pretty much anything, but John Turturro in Quiz Show is like tip of the cap, you know, just unbelievably good. And I think I had said to him 80 times, you're going to win an Oscar. And he did.
Do you remember who won that year?
I do not.
I can't remember either, but, you know, sometimes winning in retrospect isn't all that important historically.
That's true. Because,
you know, now in 2013, you got to work with Jerry Lewis in Max Rose, and he became a mentor to you. You introduced him at the 2014 TCM Classic Film Festival. Was your association with him kind of a major highlight of your career?
Oh, my goodness. Without a doubt. I mean, again, just for me personally, in the journey of who I am, who I was when I was a little kid, who I wanted to meet, etc., who I idolized, I was just excited to meet Jerry Lewis, you know, and then to become friends with him exceeded everything. But then to do the handprint footprint thing, the unexpected gift for Matt was that we were backstage, and by this point I had been to, you know, we were friends, and I'd been to a lot of Jerry's shows and with him backstage, and I knew a lot of his routines and his bits. And so I had said to him beforehand, I go, now, do you want to know what I'm going to, and I'd also interviewed him at Screen Actors Guild. We actually already done an interview a year previous, which was really fun too. But I said, do you want to know the questions? He said, no, I don't want to know. I want you to completely surprise me, which is funny because sometimes some people want to know every little thing you're going to ask them. So we were backstage at the El Capitan Theater, and I screwed up my courage and I said, you know, Jerry, I was thinking maybe we could do a bit, you know, and he looked at me and he goes, what do you want to do? You know, he kind of, and I was there, and that was that's me watching myself. I'm like, I'm pitching a joke to Jerry Lewis, like a bit. And so we went, and he said, okay, well, how would you do it? And we started like working on it. He goes, well, what if you say this? I'm like, okay, great. Okay. So I'll say that. All right. Okay. And we worked out what we were going to say, but I was like, that for me is, you know, that for me, that's a mic drop. Like to get all the movies, whatever I've done, the fact that Jerry Lewis trusted me to do a bit with him, and I got to do a bit with Jerry Lewis, for me is like, it really doesn't get much better than that as a student of show business. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, it's pure magic. I mean, and I, in a way, I wish you had been born a little earlier. You would have met even more of those classic actors. Now, your most recent book, Ileana, Connecticut in the Movies, takes us through the transition from Connecticut being perceived as the quintessential Pleasantville to a much darker place through movies like Gentleman's Agreement, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, The Swimmer, The Stepford Wives, The Ice Storm, and many others. What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I had always had this idea of Connecticut cinema that nobody ever spoke about. And I grew up in Connecticut, and I used to tell people I was from Connecticut, and they would always have this reaction like, oh, Connecticut, you know, as if Connecticut is Greenwich and Darien. And so I always thought that people had just a general misconception about Connecticut. And then I personally, having grown up here, I always thought that the problem was that nobody had ever classified all the movies that had actually been made in Connecticut that people knew and but didn't associate it with Connecticut. And so it was, as COVID began, I thought, okay, well, this is going to be my COVID project. Let me start, you know, working on this book. But then what was unexpected was that at night I found myself, you know, again, here we go to, this was not part of the plan, or this was not part of the movie. At night, I found myself like, just sort of scrolling through Zillow, you know, nice farmhouse in the country might be fun. So that was not part of the plan at all. But I have a theory in life that you only have a certain amount of moves in you. You know, I've only moved from New York, and actors really only move coast to coast. You're in New York, you're in LA, you go to New York. And I've been in LA for 14 years, and I was thinking, I think it's time to move back to New York. You only have, you know, and I knew that this would be my last move. And that was not part of my life plan. I love my house in LA and I love my friends, but there was something about COVID that I had some theories about what I was going to be doing when COVID ended. And I said, I think I want to be on the East Coast and I want to be writing more and, you know, writing more books. And so that was the totally unexpected part, the journey of finishing the book actually in Connecticut, taking road trips around Connecticut, giving myself permission to really have fun, you know, taking time off, really enjoying the state that I grew up in that I really didn't know much about. And so, and also renovating an 1810 farmhouse, which I'm still doing.
Well, I can't resist asking you this. Is there any chance you could tell us the story of what happened when Elizabeth Taylor came to your beach house, fell in love with Gabriel Byrne and broke her nose?
That's going to be, I've got Connecticut in the movies. I have one more book that I'm going to do, a cinema book after Connecticut in the movies. And then I'm going to do a follow-up to I Blame Dennis Hopper. And it's going to be all the dark stories. And
will that one be in it?
Absolutely.
Then I'll wait, because then I can get you to come back when that book comes out.
Yeah. My days in living in Malibu, or the original Indian word, which was Malawu, they kind of approach science fiction. Malibu is one of the kookiest, strangest places. Only in Hollywood would you get a place like Malibu, where people live right on top of each other in these zillion-dollar houses, and there's no beach. And it is, talk about a social satire. But I did get to meet Elizabeth Taylor, and she did come to my beach house, and she did hit rather aggressively on Gabriel Byrne. I don't know, if it were me, I would have gone for it, but.
Yeah, me too, and I'm gay. I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Ileana Douglas, buy her books, and hear her podcasts by going to her official website, IleanaDouglas.com. You can also follow her on Facebook, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter. Well, Ileana, I have only one more question for you. Are you ready?
Sure, I'm ready.
Okay, here goes. In the movie Grief, someone says to your character, Leslie, that maybe you're a gay man trapped in a woman's body. So my question is, do you think that might actually apply to the real Ileana?
You know, it's hard to say. I would have said in the 90s, when I said that line, that it was probably most likely true. But now I'm not so sure. But it's funny you mentioned that movie, Grief, because the actor in the film, Craig Chester, we remain great friends. And I'm going to be directing the sequel to his movie, which is called Adam and Steve, which was the first gay rom-com. So I've been thinking about that comment. Am I a gay man trapped in a woman's body? Because if I'm directing a gay film, I think we will ultimately find out.
I think it's true, because you've always given me the impression as a fan that you're on the outside looking in, that we identify with you because, like you were told by Mike Nichols, you're not totally in it. You're a little bit out of it. And there's this feeling like we identify with you no matter what role you're playing. And when you're gay, trust me, you're on the outside looking in a lot of the time.
Yeah. And
so I think a little part of that is true.
Okay. Well, I take it as a huge compliment, because most of the great artists of this century have been gay men and my friends.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to say. Well, it's been such a pleasure meeting you, Ileana, having this opportunity to talk with you about your amazing life and career. Thank you for sharing your talent with us in so many great movies and TV shows. Thank you for sharing your love of film history with all of us. And especially, thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Great questions. I loved it.
Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back when that new book comes out.
I will, I promise. Give me a year.
All right. Our guest has been the incomparable actress, director, producer, and author, Ileana Douglas, whose new book, Connecticut in the Movies, is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Deborah Batsafin, my production assistants, Rosa Puzo and Margaret Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV1 Network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.